Are you ready, Kirsten?
I just realised we don't have any front matter. Because we're...
Don't, you told me you...
Can we be professional
you,
now?
No, no. Well, first off, we're not professional. And second off, you told me that you've got all this blackmail stuff
I do.
Of mine that you could just use as front matter.
But you don't want me to use that as front matter.
I've never said anything mean about anyone while these microphones
have
been
on. No, it's not mean. It's just silly.
No, I've said true stuff about people. Not mean, but it's not stuff I'd say to their face because it's true. I don't know why I do it in front of the microphone, though. Why would I say that stuff and potentially be... That is the most evil
compromised.
Laugh. Yeah, compromised. Lexicon.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
All right, start.
Okay. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. This is episode 37 of Writer and the Critic.
We don't usually say that.
No, but it deserves a certain gravitas.
What's so special about 37?
Nothing. That's the thing. That's the thing. No one ever, you know, you don't get any special parties if you turn 37 or anything, but I thought.
You don't get cake.
There are other podcasts out there. Coot Street's nearly up to its second double century.
Yes.
Thingamy Bob, Galactic, Galactic Suburbia, Thingamy Bob, Galactic Suburbia has
turned 100.
Just turned 100.
Happy century.
And yet we're floundering at 37. So I'm just trying to make a big deal out of it.
It's going to get less.
Yeah.
Anyway. Or more floundery.
Anywho. Hello, Kirsten.
Hello, Ian. How are you?
Good.
Oh, that's why we're at 37. Because we're gay. What's
right.
Gay? Is that a step down from me?
No, that's all right. I'm good. I mean, we got as you know, hinted just before, we got nominated for a Hugo Award. That's a dream come true for me. Is a dream come true for you? Just not the right category?
I don't have dreams.
You don't have dreams?
No, I'm a lifeless husk of a human being.
Have you started? You haven't started your doctorate.
I'm supposed to have.
Oh, well, that explains that then. Before we go off on that tangent, yes, so we got nominated. So that's
we did. Thank you. Thank you, everyone who voted for our
And we
nomination.
Can say with much confidence that it had nothing to do with us because I didn't nominate us. Did you nominate
no,
us?
No, I didn't nominate. No, I couldn't nominate. I wasn't eligible to nominate this year.
Why not?
Because I'm not a member of WorldCon, so.
Well, all right, you're not part of the fun then. Anyway, I was and I could have, but I didn't. But, yeah, look, I'm at the time when it was announced, I was extremely excited. It's now been, 5 weeks since it was announced?
Four-ish?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And
We actually found out the day we recorded our last podcast.
Yeah, but after.
I was going home.
Yeah.
And I got the email.
Correct.
So it's like, a whole month before we can say anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So, look, you know, and it's been great. We've people at work really don't care at all.
They would.
I said I got nominated for Hugo and they said, I don't know what that is.
Yes,
and
no.
Is it a venereal disease? And I said, sometimes. And what?
Oh.
I speak very frankly to the people at work.
Sometimes.
I told my family, again, lack of care. But they will understand it when I get my Hugo pin. Are you going to London? Because I'm not.
No.
Why aren't you going?
I'm not going to London because I went to Brighton last year and I can't afford to go to London this year.
But we're obviously going to win. So someone's going to be.
Well, I know that that 2/3 of Galactic Suburbia will be there and at least 1/2, if not the whole of Coot Street will be there.
Oh, no, the whole of Coot Street will be there.
Sure, we can find someone to accept an award on our behalf in the unlikely event.
Someone's already asked me.
Et cetera, et cetera. Someone's oh, well, there you go.
Asked.
We're sorted.
No, but I thought you'd be there.
No, I went to Brighton. I went to World Fantasy in Brighton. And that's my international con
well, that was poorly
done
planned.
For the next 5. I know. I had a choice. And we went with World Fantasy.
But you must have known we'd get nominated anyway. yes.
Stop
so,
it.
So, it'd be lovely if we were there, but we won't be.
No,
so,
but we will watch on Twitter. In the early hours of the morning. No, we won't. I will not watch on Twitter. Wake up and find out.
I'm intending to take the morning of work off to watch at 7:30 in the morning. No, because I want to watch it.
Okay.
How often do you get nominated for a Hugo?
Morning of work off.
If you're not Dave Langford,
Twitter.
If you're not Dave Langford, how often do you get nominated for a Hugo?
How do you put that in your leave application?
What? No, you just
need
say
to take a half day, have to watch Twitter.
It's the... There's a live feed, not the Twitter. There's a live
thing. Oh, you're going to watch the feed. Okay.
The Hulu or whatever it is, whatever service that they use. I'll watch that if it's working because it's
working.
Had issues. But no, you don't go tell your boss. You say to him, I'll be late for an hour.
I am nominated for an award. I must have the day off. And he'll say, what award? And you'll say, never mind.
Although, the fan categories are done first. By the time they get through them,
you could probably get to work on time.
On time, yeah. But if we win, I might be so elated and the adrenaline may be pumping through my body so much that I actually can't physically get out of the house.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
Actually, that's probably true.
What?
I think you will be prone with adrenaline.
If I was funny, I'd film myself as well, but I'm not going
You'd
to.
You'd what?
Film myself.
Feel.
Film. Film.
Film.
Feel.
I thought you said feel. It's not out of line from what you might say. I'll just point out. You've said worse.
I have, but I enunciate perfectly. I don't understand why you can't listen.
Thank you, Christopher Pine.
Yeah. That's a bit political. And Australian, so only a third of our audience understood what you just said. Anywho, let's talk about the books.
Let's talk about the books. What are we talking about today?
Well, we didn't recommend either of these books to each other. We allowed the Aurealis Award judges to recommend these books
we
to
did.
Us. The first book is Lexicon by Max Barry, which won the Best Science Fiction Award.
And was also, strangely, now that I've read it, very strangely, nominated and shortlisted for the Best Fantasy
Award. How's that?
Well, it just was.
What's a fantastical element?
This is what I mean. Now that I've read it, it's like, really?
I know it has a sort of
fantasy.
It has a Harry Potter feel or a sort of X-Men feel with the school, but
it's not magic.
No.
Although
it has effects of, it looks like magic.
But that's like Clark's Law, isn't it? So, but it's not magic. It's meant to be science. It's meant to be, this is what could happen. In terms of neuroscience and linguistics.
Within a fantasy world, magic is science as well.
Within
the context of a fantasy world.
Is Snow Crash fantasy? Because that can't happen. What about Neuromancer? What about not even half, what about 90% of the science fiction books ever written that we now know can't happen must be fantasy
A lot of people think that...
It's science fiction. It is clearly science fiction.
Neurochemistry and neurolinguistics is considered to be a fantastical thing at the best of times. And as we don't understand the mind, it may as well be fantasy.
Yeah, no, don't buy it.
Okay. Shouldn't have been shortlisted according to Kirsten in the Fantasy Awards. Just a note to the judges there, you failed.
I do not agree.
Area. And the second book we're doing is Fairy Tales for Wild Girls by Elise Neer, which was nominated for both Young Adult and Horror and won both categories.
It co-won the Young Adult. These Broken Stars by Amy Kaufman was also won the Best Young Adult Novel, so it was a tie.
Now, he explained this to me. How does it get nominated, A, in the horror category and, B, not in the fantasy category?
I don't know. Judges.
Because it is. God, people have got to.
To be fair, it may not have been put into the fantasy category.
Okay.
I don't know. I didn't go back and see what categories it was.
Well, someone somewhere isn't. Because obviously I know genre better than anyone.
You do.
That's the first thing we need to understand. And now, I don't expect my horror novels all to have serial killers or vampires in them. But this. Well, first of all, it didn't feel horrific. I mean, it's got a...
I wondered about that. Are we talking about this one first?
No, we're talking about Lexicon.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll get to that.
Okay. Well, you promise?
I promise.
All right. Well, let me read the back of Lexicon then, because that's
so
the
we're going to talk about Lexicon first, which was, as we said, was nominated for fantasy and science fiction, and it won the Best Science Fiction Novel at the Aurealis.
Interestingly, beat Rupetta.
Yeah.
Which won the Tiptree, which I've read.
I need to borrow that off you because that's a really expensive book.
I have a...
and I'm a struggling student again.
I have a DRM copy of it, unfortunately, an Obi copy.
Oh, there is an e-copy? That would be less expensive.
It's not expensive.
I will buy the e-copy.
$7 or something.
Oh, great. I'll get that. I did not know. I thought it was just a beautiful, gorgeous book.
This is not a podcast, though, to review Rupetta.
No, it's not.
Can I do the back of the book, please?
Yes, go for it.
Thank you. So, Lexicon.
Lexicon.
2 years ago, something terrible was unleashed in an Australian mining town called Broken Hill. What did I call it? In the car? I said, well, that terrible thing that happened in Broken Rock.
Broken Rock.
And you said, what? You said, are you Australian or not?
I don't understand.
I thought, because I had this thing in my head that he'd made up a town and not actually used a real Australian town. being an Australian who lives in Melbourne. Anywho, thousands died in Broken Hill, that is. Few people know what really happened. Emily Ruff is one of them. She belongs to a nameless organisation of poets, masters of manipulation, who use the secrets of language to warp others to their will. She was one of their most promising recruits until she made a catastrophic mistake. She fell in love. Will Park knows the truth too, only he doesn't remember it, and he doesn't know why he's immune to the poet's powers. But he knows he needs to run. As their stories converge, the past is revealed, and the race is on for a deadly weapon, a word, because the poets know that words can kill. Once again, a blurb that gives away far too much.
I don't know that it does.
Yes, it does.
I think you get all of that pretty damn quickly.
I didn't read the blurb, so no, I don't think you do.
Okay. I didn't read the blurb either.
I mean,
I don't read blurbs.
Even the concept of the bear word, which is the word that can kill.
Yeah, that's actually, yeah, that's true.
You don't get told that.
Well, it's not the word that can kill either. The blurb is misleading, so that's, yeah.
Yes, it's the word that can compromise and then tell you to kill yourself.
Well, it can tell you to do anything.
Anything
you were told to do.
Yes. Yeah, that's very true. So, we read this book. Now let's move on to the next book. I read it some months ago. I did not reread it for the podcast, which is possibly a sin. I will say that.
Well, you only read it, February or something?
Yeah, February, three months ago. I did review it on my website, and at the time. Well, so I'm a big Max Barry fan. I love Jennifer Government. I love Company, which is my favourite of his. Syrup will always have a soft spot in my heart.
Yes. Syrup is a lovely book.
Did I tell you my editing course?
Yes, you told me.
Can I tell you again?
Tell us again, Ian.
Well, I did a graduate diploma in editing at RMIT and publishing. You wouldn't know it because my spelling, grammar, syntax and general editing skills are shit. Yet I passed the course, 2 years of my life that I'll never get back. Anyway, one of an editor came in from, I don't know who Max's original first publisher was, but from that publisher came in with galleys of Syrup. It hadn't been published yet, and we were given a task of editing it. And I remember the scene. It's the scene where he test drives the car.
It's been so long since
Syrup. He's got to go to a meeting, an important meeting.
Yep.
I even remember this from years ago. This is how much it's indelibly impressed in my mind. He's got to go to an important meeting, but he's got a shit car, so he's got to upgrade his car, and he does it by test driving a whole bunch of – then goes to a better place.
And
slowly but surely upgrades.
Because he turns up in a nice car, they're happy to let him test drive a better car.
So I was so taken by that. I actually forgot the actual task of editing the galley. Just enjoyed reading it, correct. And as a result, didn't do well in that part of the course. So, and probably explains why my editing syntax and grammar. I blame Max Barry for being shit at all those things. But anyway, soft spot in my heart.
Obviously.
This is not as good as Syrup.
No, or Jennifer Government, don't think.
This is a book that's described by some as satire.
It's not satire. It's
You ranted about this in the car.
Go on,
unleash the furies of the satire.
It's not. To all those multitude of reviewers out there, this book is A, not satire, and B, not filled with twists you won't pick. That's not to say it's filled with twists you will pick. It's not filled with twists. They're called plot.
There's something wrong in
the. There's so many reviewers out there going, "Oh, there's all these twists you won't expect them."
What are people thinking is satire?
Yeah, it's definitely not satire. It's a thriller with some social commentary. It's not satire.
Satire is usually poking fun at an institution of some sort.
That's
how it's normally done.
Well, it's also just in the way something is set up, and this is
there's nothing tongue in cheek about
satire.
This book.
This is not. You know, this is not presenting so it's not necessarily making fun. It doesn't have to be humorous satire. You know,
I thought that was one of the key components. Well, it just shows how little I know.
It doesn't have to be humorous satire. It can be dark satire. But I mean, it's not set up. What is it satirizing? What is this book actually satirizing?
The language.
But it's not satirizing language. This is not satire. There's social commentary in the book. That doesn't make it satire of.
Whereas Company, for example, is satirizing companies, obviously. Yeah. Jennifer Government is satirizing brands and
advertising.
And consumerism.
Yeah.
Syrup, the movie industry and the consumerism and those sorts of things. So they are genuinely satires. There is no doubt about that. There's nothing. I mean, there's funny moments in the book.
Yeah.
And I know you said humor isn't necessarily a. thing of satire. But,
it's a common component.
But compared to his other books, it's less tongue-in-cheek and it's less it's knowing just, wink to the audience.
That's what it, well, that's what it is. Satire has the knowing wink, I guess. Yeah, but this is not satire. This is not...
I mean, I've forgotten to mention Machine as well, but Machine Man.
Not read that.
But of all his books, because I've read them all, this is the most, in a sense, mainstream
This is a straight-down-the-line thriller. And that's not, like, that's not a bad thing. Well, I'm just saying. It's not satire.
Your tone of voice implies that it's a bad thing.
And there's not these, like, unpredictable... In fact, one of the things I appreciated about Lexicon was that it didn't play fast and loose with these unexpected twists. In fact, pretty much as soon as you went, oh, I reckon Wolf must be Emily, like two or three pages later, yes, Wolf's Emily. Cool. Yeah. On we go with the story. The story, which is why you don't know what's going to happen because it's a story and that's why we read.
Yeah,
not because there are unexpected twists.
There is no radical pulling of
There is no way the story is guiding you and then suddenly it does this unexpected U-turn because actually it was setting you up to believe one thing when really it's this other thing all along. It doesn't do that.
One thing Barry's done and he's really good at it, in terms of his storytelling is providing the information when it's required.
As soon as you're beginning to suspect, because there'd be nothing more annoying than spending two-thirds of the book going, Emily must be Wolf, Emily must be Virginia Wolf. Oh, wow, that's meant to be a big reveal. I mean, that is so disappointing, right, when you're reading a book and then something comes along that you've kind of known for half the book and it's then revealed in this dramatic way. It's like, and?
Could it be the twist that it's two different timelines? The Emily story has been the past, Harry story's in the present.
If you're not picking that up really fucking quickly, like really quickly, you're not paying attention as a reader.
or haven't read much.
It's not being hidden that the timelines are disparate in terms of when they're set. Like, it's not that hard.
No, and to his credit...
Elliot is in both of them.
And to his credit, he's still able to keep balls juggling and not reveal too much. I mean, because you're doing two different timelines.
He's giving you backstory.
I agree.
I agree.
But he does it in such a way that he doesn't the expository of the backstory, while it does fill in the front story, it doesn't give away when he doesn't give away things until he needs to.
No, that's it. He's weaving the two plot lines very well, and they're supporting each other and they're providing the information within each other as they're needed. That's done very well in this book. Really, really, really well.
Yeah. I
appreciated that a lot.
But. Okay, before we get to the but, because the but could potentially go on for hours. The concept of the book, which is the fact that language has the ability to that the pen could be mightier than the sword because language has the ability to compromise us if used in the correct way.
Yeah, that we could, and which is, I mean, you know, it's Derren Brown shit, isn't it? Really, at base level,
it's what?
Derren Brown, he's not a magician. I forget what he calls himself.
that bloke. Yeah. That one on the TV. I thought you were going to say Daniel Dennett or Noam Chomsky or something.
No.
A bit high culture then.
No, but, well, because this is the application of this stuff in real life. That we can. So it's kind of that stuff.
Because it
right?
is true. Every time we speak and we communicate, every word we say does something to our neurochemistry.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So and that's said in the book.
Yeah.
Very early on.
Yeah. It's pushing the science of... I guess neurolinguistics and the manipulation of how you think and act and respond to its limits. And I love that the practitioners of this are called poets. I think that's lovely. And that they're all named when they get their working name, I guess, they are given the name of a distinguished to more or lesser degrees, depending on how good you are and how far you progress in the organization, the names of poets and writers.
But this is where it gets closest to...
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you're given your name and I don't see there ever been changing it. So it's almost like a prophecy. Like if you're good, you'll get given the name of a really famous poet or writer like Yeats or Eliot or Wolfe.
Yeah.
But if you're not, you'll give some sort of obscure person who wrote a couple of things and then died. But how do they know? Like when they give you your name, how do they know? Is that all part of the thing? So I don't know. Is that just like, is that something I'm not meant to be thinking too much about?
Yes.
Is that just a throwaway in the book? Or is this because these people are so good at analysing personality and segmenting you and deciding who you are and what you're going to do and how you're going to respond to stuff,
that
they know when they give you your name, how good you're going to be and how far you will progress in the organization?
It does beg the question, why do you need a test?
Because when Emily turns up and she's been given the name Virginia Woolf and she turns up in her job after all those years of exile, everyone's looking at her like going, wow, you must be great because you've got Virginia Woolf. Like, so they must.
Yeah, but a bit.
You know, when they christen you, as it were, they must know at that point how good you're going to be.
But in her case, they couldn't have known.
Well, Yates did know. Because Yates said, I have the name for you when you're ready.
Oh, that's right, because he's manipulating.
That's what I mean.
Oh,
so that's
that's part of the manipulation. Because let's assume Yates didn't have a bear word in his cupboard and wasn't trying to manipulate
Emily.
He probably wouldn't have given her that. In fact, she wouldn't even pass the school. She wouldn't have got a name.
Exactly, but the fact that that's how the naming system works.
But in her case, she's
this organisation must
be
able
to specific
read
case. No, they do, obviously. Yeah. I mean, that's how they get you
and
in
I
the
find
school
that
in
fascinating.
First place.
I find it fascinating that almost as though, again, you get given this name and that is stuck on you like a label and you know, oh, I'm Charlotte Bronte, I must be going far. Or I'm Joe Bloggs, who wrote a poem that got published in a newspaper in Cornwall in 1871. I'm just going to be filing for the rest of my life.
But if they know you so well, why test you? Why have a test at the school?
I don't know that you're meant to look that hard. If you start looking really closely, this
because there is a Harry Potter element
to
this novel. There is the Harry Potter element, which
there is an academy.
Yes,
it's what is it? Harry Potter? Is it the X-Men
any
academy?
Time,
is
any
it
time
any right? It's a training ground. I mean, any I don't think it's fair to say Harry Potter because people were writing books and telling stories about
academies,
people getting trained for special purposes for a long, 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 long time before Harry
true,
Potter.
True, there's no Hufflepuff, but. Can I just say that it's at the academy where we get the closest to this being a fantasy novel because language
there. But it veers off very quickly.
No, but the language.
Because she gets kicked out. I like
can
that.
Can I finish
yes,
my
go.
Sentence?
Yes, please. Yep.
God.
Sorry.
So pushy.
Yes, I am.
Can I just say I'm Hugo nominated, all right? So don't push me around. Whatever. Details. That it's there where we learn that. If you string a set of words together, you can actually get past someone's a specific person's defenses.
Yeah, and
it's like a magic spell.
A set of
it's a magic.
What spell. We would say nonsense words.
Yeah, but that's a magic spell.
Yeah,
that's where possibly the Aurealis.
Well, it's not
words,
a magic spell.
It is.
It's how the sounds of language.
No, but it's akin to a
mind.
Magic spell.
Oh, for goodness sake!
Well, abracadabra. I don't want to go into the etymology of abracadabra, but the point is that there is certain.
This book is not setting itself up as writing magic.
No, but the point
is
of
setting
magic,
itself as writing
the point of,
science.
The original point of magic is that it triggers off the machine code of the universe and allows you to manipulate reality.
Yeah.
Which is essentially what they're doing here, except to a
yes.
person.
Okay, yeah.
And so I think you can draw an argument why it's fantasy. It's a very long bow.
It's a really,
I'm not,
really long
I'm not saying
bow.
It's like accurate, but yeah. Yes. Anyway, we loved the neurolinguistic stuff and the language stuff. We love the storytelling.
Yeah.
We love the way he doles out information at the right time.
Yep.
But it's about the time when you get to the last third when you realise that the whole thing's built on a pack of cards.
It is
plot-wise.
Yeah.
And a really flimsy pack of cards.
Look, it's one of these books where Yates, who controls the organization in America, because there are organizations all over the world.
Yep.
So there's different language systems, obviously for different languages, and they don't cross over. So if someone doesn't understand another language, you're not going to be able to manipulate them in that language unless it's the bear word. And I'm still not convinced. But anyway, so Yates is the head of, I guess, the American, possibly the American / English speaking chapter. I'm not sure there's an Australian chapter because they keep having to send the Yanks over to do stuff. So maybe it's just the English-speaking chapter and the Americans are the head of that. Anyway, so if you stand back from the book, he's just got this one of those incredibly convoluted plans of essentially he's got this bear word, which is, as I understand it, meant to be this proto-language because it's a symbol, but all languages are symbolic.
Yes,
anyway.
But it's the universal language that we had before the Tower of Babel or a Babel event.
Before
language became dispersed.
Anyway, so this word, which is – it's odd to me because the way the words are used, they can be written down, obviously, but they seem to have their primary effect when they're spoken.
Right. Spoken, yep.
And verbalised, and when it's auditory, and certainly when Emily is hacking Harry / Will the attention word she comes up with to compromise him, a verbal.
Yeah, which is a bit I didn't get in the whole. That's the bit that I have found.
And so I'm not sure how a symbol.
But a symbol has the same effect. Words, and you're seeing, if I see something, I read something.
But it's they don't have the same effect, because when they get given the written words back in the academy and told to practice, 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 so your particular attention words, you become inured to them. The written words don't have the same effect as when they say them aloud to themselves in the mirror. It's much more heightened when they're speaking them to themselves.
So I suppose as part of this pack of cards, we're meant to assume that the bear word is so powerful that just looking at it,
because you couldn't verbalize it anyway.
Because we don't know the language.
Yeah, and I guess the idea is that it is somehow gone so far back to.
Well, it's machine code. Yeah. Of the universe. That's what it is. That's why it's what it is.
Of a machine of the universe or of.
Or of us.
Because if it's of the universe, you could chat to a dog, couldn't you? And
yeah, fair point.
It has to be something where your brains have linguistic structure.
The way I understood it was that it is the first language that we came up with.
Yeah, but.
Although why it's that but powerful. Why the clicks and grunts that we first came up with are any more powerful than the language we came up with.
And how that became written.
Well, at what point did it become written? Because by the time
exactly.
So I don't know the history.
This is what I mean. Anyway, let's push that aside.
No, but this is the pack of cards that this book is built on.
Okay, but let's say. So anyway.
That's the problem. So, you've got to qualify everything with let's say.
So it's got to Yates has his bear word, right?
Yates has a bear word. Not only that, not only is the bear word rare, he's got an attention bear word. So he's got the rare of a rare. He's got the card that you don't get in the pack.
Anyway, he's found that. So he's got this, and what he essentially wants to do is because they've been testing it in their office/laboratories on citizens to test what the word can do and how powerful it is.
Pretty brutally.
And essentially what he wants to do is field test it. And he wants a field test. He doesn't want it in a laboratory. He wants to have it out in the world and see what it does. And to do this, he decides to find a subject who is really good at the aggressive use of these linguistic powers.
Yep.
So she can use them to compromise other people and she can pick up on that really quickly, but she's really crap at the defensive part of it. So she's unable to kind of resist persuasion and so on.
And his view is
Emily.
And that's why he chooses her, because she's easy to compromise.
Because he can manipulate her. He can compromise her and control her, but she's really good at controlling other people.
Can I say that makes no sense? Not to explain why that makes no sense. Can I be
done? I'm building the house of cards. I'm building the house of cards.
Okay.
It's too early to shake the table.
Okay. All right. Keep going.
So he finds this person. It ends up being Emily. And his idea is to take this person after exiling them for a few years, to prime them, I guess, to be a rebel, then to bring them back into the organization, put them in a position where they'll be able to steal this bear word, where they'll want to steal the bear word, and go back to the place where he exiled them, because that's where he's decided to have the testing, because in the meantime, he knew, because I guess you know the personality of everyone down to their final little thought ever, that they would fall in love with someone, and that would then draw them back to the place where you exiled them and where you want the test to happen, with the bear word that they've taken to protect themselves, because they think you'll be coming after them, because they don't know that you've manipulated them to steal the word, to take it back to Broken Hill to perform the field test, and surely there's a simpler way. Surely there is a simpler way when you are the head of this massive shadow organization that has proven itself within the book perfectly capable of hiding major disasters and events and manipulating the media and manipulating how people think and how they receive information. There is a simpler way to field test a bear word. Isn't there, Ian?
Absolutely. There's two ways that come to mind. You could just get anyone off the road to do it. One, and just compromise him simply and just get him to drop this thing wherever you want him to drop it. Or he could get, if he wanted an agent, he's got Platt.
He's got plenty of agents sitting right next to him. He would plenty of agents who would do this.
Because one of the key things is that everyone's got their compromise.
I don't see why he needs Emily.
Everyone's got their words.
Yes.
So you could compromise anyone. Yes. I know the whole point is that Emily's defences are so weak. But once you find out someone's triggers, everyone's weak. So you could have done it to Platt and got him to go to Broken Hill. And why wait 5 years? Is Platt the hurt?
Yes.
Oh, shit. Sorry.
Traditionally.
Yeah. Yeah. That was bad. Gender, Ian. Why wait 5 years? Why have a rebel without a cause? Why not just get anyone to do this?
Unless he didn't have the bear word and he was just wanting.
But he did. Because they're testing it while she's off tootling along.
Yeah, but the timelines are. So maybe he, like, when he saw her potential to be useful at
it could
some
have been for
point
anything. It could have
to
been for
do
anything.
Something?
Yeah.
I don't know because the book isn't clear on that timeline. But
plus, you know she's a rebel without a cause.
She's a total rebel without a cause.
So you're going to compromise her, great. But you're also going to give her one of the most powerful weapons that
no,
we've
but
got.
The idea is that because her defense. Her defences, her innate ability to resist persuasion is so poor that he can control her.
Okay.
And he does. I mean,
but he's still taking a risk.
He puts stuff in her head.
But there's a
he...
risk still.
Of course
this is
a
someone
risk.
Who hates your organisation.
Of course there's a risk.
Why not have someone who at least loves
because
your
Because I guess you've got the hubris of Yates who believes, you know, almost 100% rightly that he can control her because he doesn't understand the power of love.
Yeah, that's how it is. Look, the thing that shat me, which that shat me was that she was able to program yeah. Will/Harry so quickly in it. That it's made clear that coming up with someone's trigger words isn't something you just do overnight. It is something you have to work to. And yes, I know she's really good on the attack, but the fact that she's basically able to crack this one person who she loves so quickly, and I know that.
Well, the idea is that because she does love him and know him so well, she has a better sense of his reactions.
But there was no indication that she's
things.
Ever tried to do this to him.
No, she hasn't. I can kind
it just seems
of let
convenient
that,
for the. Look, I know
can,
you.
I can
know
let
you,
that slide a little. Like it, I did. It did. I did go. Oh, come on, really? But okay, I'll just let it slide a little. I'll see where you're going with that. I will buy that she's been learning this stuff from first principles, as it were, right? Because she's been exiled and she hasn't been taught, so she's learning from first principles. The metaphor used is like cracking a safe and listening for the tumblers to fall as you manipulate it. So that's which is a lovely metaphor, really good metaphor.
But
talk
she's doing
about
it at a million
works.
Miles per hour because she's about to. You know,
okay, but anyway, but
ship.
She does it.
Okay.
She does it. Right. She comes up with this string of syllables to compromise Harry, and the instruction she gives him is for him to go away. To forget about her, to forget about everything, to pretend none of this ever happened. And she does it so well that that's exactly what he does. He becomes Will Park. His brain concocts this story for himself as to who he is because he's been told to forget, okay? Yep. But then at the very end, which the ending of this book made me so angry.
Yeah, I know because you've been rabbiting on about it since we
and took out. But then at the very end where she uses those words again, it's suddenly, inexplicably, and we're given no reason, we're not even shown what happens. But obviously they completely fail to work.
Because of love.
Because of love. But see, Harry's not trained. See, I could get that, okay, this the idea that love is the ultimate bear
word. Can I say,
word.
Can I quote it?
Please quote it.
This is what she says to Yates because this is right at the end, just before. This is where Yates finds out that she's no longer compromised. She says, I don't think you've been in love. Not recently anyway. I'm not sure you remember what it's like. It compromises you. It takes over your body like a bear word. I think love is a bear word. That's the first thing. Yates didn't react. If anything, he seemed baffled. The second thing is I wouldn't characterize Harry as indecisive and untrained with weapons. Oh, that's
yeah,
the
that's
other bit.
The which is a good line. It's funny.
Yeah. But anyway, yes, love is a bear word. So essentially because she's in love with Harry, she's able to break the hold that Yates has on her.
Yep.
Through so love has allowed her to
and
do
I
that.
And I could get that because she's been chipping away at it for months, for all the time she's been under Yates.
But the fact
control.
That now Harry is coming to rescue her, essentially, or Harry is back to being Harry and is, you know, it's all the way it was before. That love element has really given her that final push that she can now break Yates.
Because she
hold.
Thought he was dead.
Yes.
Because she'd told herself to think that Harry was dead.
Yes. So
which that, really when you think about it again, another, you know, Queen of Hearts on the top of the card house there. The book has said that because she caught a glimpse of the bear word, right? When because what happened was the bear word got taken back to Broken Hill and kind of accidentally, kind of well, not accidentally, because Yates had like programmed her to do this. So she left it in the emergency room, whether she was meant to leave it exactly there. But anyway, it ends up in the emergency room in the hospital and she's pinned a note to it. So the bear word's there and the note says, kill everyone. So anyone who sees this word and the note will just start killing everyone they see forever until they die. And she doesn't see the bear word, but she catches a glimpse of a reflection, which means it would be mirrored. So does it have the same effect if it's mirrored?
Apparently it does.
Hmm. Anyway. Okay. So
and it's caught in her eye.
So she sees this tiny like a glimpse of it. So that's and so she is kind of programmed to kill everyone too, but I guess it's diluted because she didn't see it full on all the right way around. And because of that, because it's I guess the bear word is compromised, or his effect is compromised, she's able to channel kill everyone into just kill Yates. But Yates is controlling her. So she can't kill Yates. Because if she kills Yates, then she'll kill everyone. So she's kind of got a bit of control over it, but only in this specific way. Okay, so it's kind of this shaky. But it's made very clear that you can't get rid of that. And if you use the bear word again to override it, it won't override it. Like that command will be there and will be there forever.
Yeah.
So her command to herself when she looked at the bear word full on looked at it was Harry's dead. How does she ever not think Harry's dead, really? How does every time Harry's out of her sight,
yeah,
does she not think Harry's dead?
That's a very good question.
Because that command is there forever. The book says that. It's there forever. Does love override? So love overrides the bear word.
Yeah, love. It's really unfortunately, yeah. That is it. Love conquers all.
And no, I'm sorry. No. because at the end,
but I think the point is that love gets you down to your bare bones, gets past bare words, it gets past all the neurolinguistic shit, just gets you to your very, very core, which is a very romantic view on love. I mean, it is. I mean, this is very schmaltzy in that sense.
Look, pardon, but you can take that. You can take that sentimental bullshit and you can just go.
It depends on how much you buy into that. Because
love is responsible.
Barry would argue that I believe that about love, and therefore it makes sense mm-hmm. to me that love is essentially the ultimate nullifier, if you're a Marvel Comics fan, that can get beyond any bear word. Because it doesn't even. I mean, you could argue it's not even language; it's an emotion.
Yeah,
like, it's not language. So how does it even? It's not a word.
It's not a word, is it? But it's how your brain.
Does it mean pure anger is a bear word? Does
exactly.
That mean,
why is love the preferred emotion?
Yeah,
people do much more dramatic things in the name of anger or hatred than they ever do in the name of love.
Yeah,
really.
You're right.
So now emotions are the bear words. In which case, what the fuck? So what made me so angry about the end was you at the very end, it is the very end, it's the last line of the last chapter of the book before the end matter, which we'll get to, is that Emily/Virginia Woolf realizes that she still has this bear word in her head, this kill everyone command, it's not going to go away, she's a danger to everybody in the world, including the people she cares about. And she gives Harry the instruction as he comes towards her with his rifle, and she uses his attention string of words that she's coded, that he is not trained to resist, that he's not trained to even, he has no training. Elliot's kind of explained how stuff works, but that's not the same as training and resisting those words and repeating them to yourself. He doesn't even know what his words are. No one knows except Emily, because he's... Until she figured out his words, he's immune to his his distinct personality type, so he has no words. And he's immune to the bear word. He's immune to the bear word,
and yet he's
which undermines everything, apparently, which is pre-language, which is pre-anything, and yet he has attention words.
Yes, that's right, and that's why I didn't get how she tumble-locked him.
It doesn't make sense.
That's why I didn't understand how she tumble-locked him.
He's immune to the uber word. And yet he's got this lesser one.
Correct. That's why I didn't say that.
Anyway,
not only is it, but you'd think he'd be the hardest person to tumble lock.
Yeah.
If the guy who can't fucking be compromised by a bear word.
By a bear word.
You'd think he'd be the one last person. Let's say he does have an attention thing.
Yeah.
He'd be the toughest to do.
Anyway. But his attention thing. And then suddenly, obviously it doesn't. And what she says is she gives his attention word and says, Harry, I need you to shoot me. And it's a fantastic ending. It's great because Emily does, as Emily, not as Wolf, because she was never really Wolf. Emily does what Elliot, who is her mentor and a father figure.
Her mentor's not able to kill her.
Elliot can't kill her because mentor, father figure can't do what's right. Yates won't do it because he wants to manipulate her and control her and use her. Emily does the one thing no one else can or will do, the thing that's right. And it's a fantastic ending.
Then what happens,
and then
Kirsten?
Then you flip over and there is a couple of little, what I call the inserts that Barry's put into the book, which are really good. You've got paper articles. No, like they're through the book, right? So you've got newspaper articles. You've got comments from websites. You've got all this stuff which is filling out you know, the commentary on how this language works and the bit of world building and stuff like that. So we've got a couple of those. Nice. Oh, here's a bit of thoughts about how the bear word works. Like, yeah, still not know that I'm with you there, but okay. And then you flip over to this tiny epilogue, which made me so angry. It was like this final little.
It was like a bear word for
you. It was like this breath of wind that just collapsed that whole house of cards.
Yeah, it was like a bear word for you. It completely compromised the entire book for you.
It did. It absolutely did. Because the ending is suddenly, it's gone from this situation where, you know, Yates is dead and Elliot is dead and Harry's coming with a gun and Emily said, this has to end. You need to shoot me. Done. Curtain closed. Brilliant. To suddenly Harry, Emily in some little farmhouse somewhere, and Harry's milking a cow, and it's all idyllic, and there's the sunrise, and Emily's there, and they cuddle up together, and they love each other, and
no, but I think you missed the point of that scene.
And
they've gone to an isolated spot because she's still got the bear word in her. He obviously has to tell her not to kill him every day,
but
to remind her because that's because he's using love.
Yeah, but no, again,
no, he's. If they went into the city,
yes, there'd be too many people there. But he can say, you know, you love me, therefore don't kill me.
So I'll take on the risk, live out in the middle of nowhere, and we'll die here together, looking at the sun and milking cows.
He better hope he never leaves the fucking toilet seat up, not even once, or leaves his socks lying on the bedroom floor, or just, you know, forgets to pick up milk.
It comes down to whether you can accept that love is strong enough.
Seriously.
To negate the bear word. That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, I don't accept that.
If you don't buy that.
Don't buy it.
You're...
And I think that ending, it robs Emily of,
the choice
of what she did.
But she still made the choice, though.
Yeah, but it robs her of that.
Yeah, but she still made the choice. She's not robbed. She made the choice.
Yeah, but it undermines.
It's not her fault the love is so powerful.
Yeah, she's a bit lovesick.
I don't know if it undermines it. I think it's simply that is what we're told. Love is.
It diluted the power of that ending.
I agree with you.
It's like the ending, as I mentioned to you when we were driving over here, it's like the ending for Minority Report, that film, where you have the three triplets who were the psychic ones. And you've got the end of this movie, which is not a bad movie, you know, for all the Tom Cruise. And you've got these three people who cannot even be people. Considering how they have spent their entire lives
basically
and what they've seen, and they have had no human socialization, and can they even read? But they're in this idyllic little cabin in the woods, and they're wearing soft woolly jumpers, and a fire's going, and their hair's growing back, and they're reading books, and they're so happy. And it's like, fuck off.
And that's what you said at the end of this, isn't it?
Don't give me that sentimental pat because.
But that's what it comes down to for this book. I mean, I think that he doesn't play by his own rules.
No, he doesn't.
I think that's the key thing.
He does not.
And I think you've said other things that aren't specifically linked to the love issue around the bear word and the instructions you get. They're just
and how they work. And how Emily got out of – I know Yates wanted her to get out, but unless Yates is in control of every single tiny aspect of how the organization runs.
How do you do a copy of a bear word without actually looking at it?
Well, what she said was she went in there with her eyes shut where the bear word was and she took – all these photographs. So in one of those photographs, the bear word was going to be there. And then she went and she blew all the photographs up to pixels and she looked really hard and she found what, and she just did it by pixel. So she, I don't know.
I can't take a photograph with my eyes fucking open.
I hope that focus was good. It must have been an awesome camera.
Well, it's a smartphone. So, you know, but
no, I don't, there's too much. I didn't. Because basically how she gets out of there, she masquerades it as a test subject, right? Yep. And so she goes in and she gets shown the bear word, but she knows what it is, so she closes her eyes and she puts her fingers in her ears or something and goes, la, la, la. I think literally that's what she does. And so she doesn't compromise it. And then she sort of smashes the box that's in and the reason she's able to do all this is because there's no video cameras in the room. And there's no live monitoring of her. They're hooking her up to helmets and they're monitoring everything. And there are video cameras in the room, but they're not feeding out. They're not live. If you worked in any organization and you've got this really powerful, possibly unpredictable, essentially weapon, wouldn't someone be going, you know, we should have a live feed? We really should have a live feed.
Yeah, look.
But no one, and obviously it's not because Yates wants her to escape. But again, it's one of these things where there's so many things that can go wrong with your plan that are dependent on how well you know that person and what they're going to do. And there's got to be – there's security. I mean, these people are not incompetent. You're right. Security is going to be working in that organisation going, this is ridiculous. We need a live feed to that room. We don't have to look at the bear word in the box, but we need a live feed on the subject.
You're right. When you come up with convoluted plans like that
– you know?
There are so many things that go wrong. And also what the fact that Yates gets disposed of – I know you thought it was cute, but it annoyed me.
It is annoying. I didn't think it was –
the guys come up with this megalomaniacally convoluted plan and yet –
he's undone by his love of expensive footwear.
Correct, literally. She drops some water on his footwear and he gets so upset she can slit his throat.
She can slit his throat because his shoes are wet.
I think that's a gag.
I'm sorry. It is a gag and it is set up earlier, but it's a gag. So the book does things.
Again,
it's one of those things,
you either get the joke or you don't, and you either get love or you don't.
Yeah.
And Max Barry would probably say that you're a soulless, unlovable person because
– unlovable.
Well, I think you're lovable. Aww. I think you're lovable, but
my mother would disagree.
Well, it's more than just the fact that love conquers all. It's what it is.
It's love conquers all. I think
there's more. The deck of cards isn't just blown over because of the love conquers all. It's blown over because of all the other things you've mentioned around the convoluted plan.
Well, that's why it's a deck of cards, right? Okay. It's not this solid foundation that's there.
Yeah, okay.
And you go, okay.
And the love conquers all.
Because everything is, okay. Right? Yeah. The fact that you're forgiving so much stuff as you're reading this book and going, all right, we'll let that one slide. Okay, all right, I'll buy that she can do that. Okay, yes. Well, and then you get that end. It's like, what the fuck?
Anyway, I won an Aurealis Award, so congratulations, Max.
But, I feel like because I didn't hate the book. I think there was a lot in the book that was really interesting. I think this was one of those shadow books that I liked, actually. I like the shadow book to Lexicon.
Oh,
you mean
the book that it could have been?
Yeah, I liked because all the inserts that he had there and the stuff about manipulation in the media and targeting advertising and websites so you only see what you're – so there's a feedback loop set up in your interactions with the world.
Which you feel is a more interesting novel.
Which is where I thought it was going.
But he's done it. He's done it to death. He's done that shit. So you wanted to tell a straight down the line thriller, which still involved all the things he's interested in, but didn't focus on those. But you feel that with that particular concept, actually, he would have been better focusing on the things that he's done to death anyway, but than the thriller element.
I guess.
I mean, it is what it is. You're right.
And
it's a shadow
book. And I loved Emily, and I really liked Elliot as a character too. I thought Elliot was great. Will gets very short shrift because you never get to know him as either Will or Harry. Properly.
No, he's either confused and angst or then becomes highly competent.
Yeah, but
literally, flick of the switch, he goes from, oh, what's going on to, I can fire guns and kill people really well. Look, we've given Lexicon
But as I said, I enjoyed, for the most part, I enjoyed reading it enough that I was willing to push all these things aside.
No, because
as they came up.
The storytelling is spot on.
Yeah.
We give sport. Basically, the entire book. But if you've only listened to this bit here, you will be compelled to read on.
I think if it had a better ending, I don't just mean the epilogue. I mean like the last chapter. No.
Let's go to the next book.
Because otherwise, how? Okay. I have questions.
Well,
Elliot's right then. Harriet doesn't actually love Emily.
What we should do?
Because he was able to.
What we should do? Is give Max a copy of this podcast after he hates us for listening to especially the last bit. We then go visit him at his house.
Can I just say, if Harry really loved Emily, he didn't resist her compromising him. Like he couldn't resist that at all. That worked like instantly, immediately, forgotten, done. So love didn't conquer that. And then suddenly he does love her after not even being Harry for ages. And when Harry didn't actually love her like that, so how does his love manage to make him conquer her using his words? It just.
I don't have answers to your questions, so we'll knock on his door. We'll say, Max, you happy to let us in first? And if you are, can you answer these questions for us?
Oh, there's so much I really liked about this book. I really, really wanted it to come together at the end. And as I said, I was willing to forgive or suspend my disbelief enough to get to the end and see how he managed to resolve all that. And I don't think he resolved it. I don't think he resolved it. It's not just to my dark, soulless taste. It's not just that. It's not just that I'm anti-love, which I'm not, by the way, but It's just within the book. It doesn't make sense. The ending does not make sense.
Does the ending of Fairy Tales for Wild Girls make sense?
See how are we moving on?
Well,
you're moving me on.
You know, as much as I've enjoyed your rants.
Okay. It wasn't really a rant, but I guess it was. Okay. Okay. We are moving on.
Can you please describe this book to us?
Yes. So this is Fairy Tales for Wild Girls by Alice Near. And it is it's kind of a fairy tale. It's a story about a girl called Isola Wild, or Isola Wild, I think is how you pronounce it. And she sees fairies and magic and ghosts and things of that ilk. And her mother is in some kind of sort of manic depression I got through the book. First just depression, but then there seems to be a sign that she's actually probably manic depressive.
Yep.
And her father is...
Well, there's definitely a sign of bipolar.
Yeah. And her father is not estranged because he's living in the house, but he's emotionally estranged, I guess, from them both. And she's trying to sort of figure out her world.
As she grows up
because she's 16.
Yes.
And that's the book.
So here's a book that is...
I should read the end, actually. Yeah, well... not the end, the blurb. So the blurb is... There's a dead girl in a birdcage in the woods. That's not unusual. Side note, it is actually. The book makes it very clear that that's very fucking unusual. But anyway. Isola Wild sees a lot of things other people don't. But when the girl appears at Isola's window, her every word a threat, Isola needs help. Her real-life friends, Grape, James, and new boy Edgar, make her forget for a while, and her brother princes, magical creatures, seemingly lifted from the pages of the French fairy tales Isola idolizes, will protect her with all the fierce love they possess. It may not be enough. Isola needs to uncover the truth behind the dead girl's demise before the ghost steals Isola's last breath.
Okay.
Can I say this book? I should have adored this book beyond all measure.
Yes.
It should have been all the Kirsten Buttons pressed Whereas all
it,
at
it's
once.
It's not the sort of book I would normally like, but yeah. I have to say I really enjoyed the first. That I liked how that she introduced the characters. Mm-hmm. I liked the interesting way she did it. It's not just straight narrative.
I did. I liked the little
sort of box scenes that.
Yep.
You know, emboldened things like that.
You've got stuff like film scripts. You've got stuff like synopses. You've got little sort of interjections from
correct.
An authorial voice.
And it's an thing. And it's an author and a debut author who's playing around with narrative, which
it's
absolutely
nice.
Applaud. Well done. But then it just slogs. It just becomes a slog for the next third, and the last third isn't that much. It does get better when the gargoyle appears.
I love the gargoyle.
The gargoyle is the saving grace of the last third,
so
but then you get the revelation at the end, which we'll probably talk about, which shattered me as much as you were shattered by Love Conquers All with Max Barry.
It shattered me a little in this book. This book is also, not surprisingly, but again, our books kind of, we didn't even pick these ones. Again, the end of this book is also Love Conquers All. That is this book as well. Love conquers all.
It
even
is.
Mental illness, especially mental illness, which shagged me too.
At times,
can I say?
See, that's the thing. It is about mental illness, which is a delicate topic at the best of times, and at times it is very mature about that subject, completely undermined by the ending.
Yeah.
And I sort of think we have to talk about the ending straight away and not sort of dilly-dally.
No, well, everyone, we just spoilt the fuck out of Lexicon, so I don't see why.
Can I just say that Kirsten has sworn a hell of a lot more than me in this episode? And
Kirsten
that should be
is a bit tired. She's had about 4 hours sleep.
Because she's playing Dungeons and Dragons.
I was indeed.
Yes. Mm. Not relevant to this book, though.
No.
So I call it the Fight Club phenomena, which is a character you think who's present in the novel turns out not to have existed at all. It can also be the Sixth Sense phenomena or any fucking other multitude of films that's done the same trick.
Yeah.
So here's the spoiler, people. This so-called estranged mother who's bipolar, etc., actually is well and truly dead.
She's dead. She killed herself when Isola was on her 10th birthday, actually.
So the reason why the father's estranged from the mum is because
she's
the mum doesn't exist.
Yeah.
The only person she exists to is Isola, who hasn't figured out, well, for whatever mental breakdown reasons, hasn't figured out that her mum actually is a ghost. Well, not there.
And the dead girl in the woods is actually the part of Isola that died when her mum committed suicide.
Yes. Now, that happened when she was 9 years old, correct?
Tenth birthday. And the witch in the woods who's responsible for all the ills in the book, that happen. Isola's brother Prince is being abducted, possibly killed. The dead girl in the woods who was killed by the dead girl's mother, who's the witch in the woods, the death of the woods, the death of the plum tree, Isola's attacks upon her person. She gets really thin, her ribs become like a bird cage. She gets all these bruises on her body. All of that's caused by the witch in the woods, who, as I'm going through the book, I'm thinking, okay, it's either going to be Isola's mother, and that's why Isola's mother's sort of asleep all the time, because she's actually the witch in the woods, or it's going to be Lilio Perdue, who's the fairy tale, the writer of the French fairy tales, who Isola's mother adored.
Who's just been hanging
and who's
out
got
in the
book,
woods.
And Lilio's stories are excerpted throughout fairy tales for wild girls. And in the end, I was both right. Because it is Isola's mother who's dead and is therefore the witch. And Isola's mother was also Lilio Perdue, the fairy tale writer.
Yes.
And the book has kept that from us.
Yes.
And I don't buy it.
Yes, I don't buy it either.
I don't buy that.
I don't buy that the father in 16 years to a daughter never mentioned the connection. I mean, he knew who she was.
And Isola knows too. She's just forgotten or deliberately pushed that aside as well. But I don't know why she had to push that aside. Why, when she's saying my mum died, she's not pretending this other fairy tale woman's still alive.
Yeah, so what difference does it make?
Why does it matter that her mum, you know, I'm not sure why that's there, other than to be kind of these red herrings, like who's going to be the witch, who's going
to
be the witch.
Something was clear to me is, when does she forget? So can you explain to me, her 10th birthday, the mum decides to kill her. The mum's at a height of her bipolar, so she's all active. Yes. She decides for reasons that
are
explained.
Because she's named Isola Wilde after Oscar Wilde's younger sister.
Who died at the age of nine.
So Isola's mum has decided in her view of the world, which is not sane at this point, that Isola will also die then before she's 10, because the original Isola did, so her daughter will. And the only way she can stop this is by sacrificing herself.
Which she does.
Which makes perfect insane sense to someone who's in that condition.
Okay, stop there. Is it for the next 6 years that Isola rubs the fact that her mum's dead?
I guess so.
Oh, I thought it was but then how's that possible?
I don't know. Well, see, it's possible, but the book is either cheating or it's just really
I mean, how does no one else, the father for one, but put the father aside, friends, they would have asked, how's your mum? Can I see your mum? There's got to be.
Well, the idea is that everyone knows. It's only Isola. And Isola is somehow, even though she knows, like, so Isola's pretending her mother is not dead.
Not pretending. She's convinced.
No. Just bear with me for a second. Isola's pretending her mum isn't dead to the extent that this is real to Isola. Her mum is not dead. So she would be mentioning that to people.
Yes.
Like, people would not be asking, like, her mum's dead. And people aren't going to be coming up with everything going, how are you going with your mum's death? But she would, in some way, in passing, like her best friend Grape. That day, she stays home because her mum's had a really bad day, and she stays home because she's worried her mum's going to kill herself. And she stays home that whole day from school. Yeah. She doesn't mention to her very best friend Grape the next day when she goes back to school, and Grape says, "Hey, why aren't you there?"
And she does. And she doesn't say, "Oh, her father," from time to time, and her father loses the plot.
But it's cheating.
Yes, it is.
Cheats like that at the end, because at the very beginning, when we first get it, and her mum's in the kitchen, and it's that sixth sense moment. To make an analogy, when Bruce Willis is in the restaurant with his wife, right? So we get this very early on, which is a clever way to set up, because you have a character who's not the person who can see the ghost interacting with the ghost. Or so you think, because when you go back and watch The Sixth Sense, no, Bruce Willis doesn't actually interact with anyone at all. It's really cleverly done. And neither, this book tells us, does her father. Because Isola, at the beginning when she's talking in the kitchen, she mentions her mother, and she mentions Alejandro, who's one of her brother princes, and her father cracks the shits and goes, "You're too old to have imaginary friends," and storms out. And, okay, because you know Alejandro is not her brother. He's also a ghost or a spirit or something conjured, and you think that this is Isola's, this is the type of madness that people see Isla having. She has imaginary friends that she talks to.
Not that she believes her mother is dead. Not that she believes her mother is dead. Well, right? No, so not that she believes that her mother is a ghost.
And at the end...
No, it's not even that. She believes her mother's alive.
Alive, sorry. Right? Yeah, and at the end of the book, that same scene in the kitchen is explicitly replayed for us on the page when Isla realises, oh, no, Dad wasn't angry about Alejandro. He was angry about mentioning my mother.
Yes.
And that, to me, excuse my French, again, 4 hours of sleep, is fucking bullshit. Because if your 16-year-old daughter who's there, who's obviously must have been mentioning her fucking mother being alive throughout these 6 years, and, you know, and she says it again, and you don't say you're too old to have imaginary friends. You say your mother is dead, Isla, right? You don't talk about imaginary friends. Your wife, your dead wife, and your daughter's mother is not her imaginary friend.
Wouldn't Elise
it's
Neil.
A linguistic trick. So that at the beginning of the book,
yes,
we ground the mother as having an interaction with the father, and we don't think of her as not being possibly present,
yes,
in the
said,
book.
A cheat.
Right? But it is a cheat, because that is not how, in retrospect, that you know that is not
but
how
isn't the
father
the point?
Would react.
That. For all we know, Grape's been saying to her for the last 6 years, your mum's dead, your mum's dead, your mum's dead, and she just doesn't hear it.
Yeah, possibly. But
and the father's possibly saying
the
as well.
The problem is...
Hey, Isola, mum... dead. Yeah. And she's hearing.
So did she make up the conversation about imaginary friend?
Maybe.
But that isn't the book, because the book, Isla is not the narrator. We do not have an unreliable narrator here. We have a book with an authorial voice.
That's
who
the
is
flaw.
Putting in
yes.
so much stuff that Isla doesn't know. And unless Isla is writing this book in third person and making everything up and imagining what Edgar is having conversations with and imagining how all these other people where she's not even present are thinking and having...
Which, you can't trust the novel. You're right.
The novel is... And when you're working with... material that is by its very nature, you're talking about unreliable perspectives on the world, you're talking about fragmented personalities, you're talking about all this stuff which shifts beneath the reader. You need the book to give you a very solid grounding, and this book doesn't. And I don't trust the reliability of the overarching story.
No, I agree. If it was told
because
in first...
I don't think the language is careful, so I don't have faith.
Tell the story in first person, and you can, even though I still think it would annoy me, you can still make the unreliable narrator argument, although it's so...
Or tell it in intensive third person if you don't want to use third person.
Okay,
make it
where
all from Isola's
her.
Point
it's
of
only
view.
Her, yeah. No one else...
And, and then you
Because we get scenes from
well.
Edgar's perspective, we get Grape's point of view on the world, we get other people's point of views. Mm-hmm. No one in there...
Has ever said Isla thinks her mum's alive.
Correct. No one seems
I'm
to be...
I'm really worried about Isla. She still thinks her mum's alive.
She still thinks her mum's alive, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it would be fucking obvious, wouldn't it?
I would think so. I would think so.
Do you think she's playing too hard and loose with the concept of mental illness? Because one of the thematic elements of the novel is the mystical, magical stuff real, or is it a symptom of the mental illness?
These are your options.
And the book doesn't really.
I think the book, because you have these, you have the woman who was Roskin's, the fairy who gave Roskin to Isla.
Yep.
Also sees magic, so she's a confirmation character that what Isla's seeing isn't all in Isla's head, because you've got this other neighbor who sees the magic and sees.
Yeah, but that's just someone playing into her mania. I mean, say
she gives her. Fairy.
Yeah, but no. She says, I have a fairy that you can... He's playing into her...
Delusion.
The delusion, yeah, that's all.
It could be. But I don't think the book... I don't think the book is doing that. I think the book is grounding very firmly in this is what Isla can see. But then what that means is... What the book is saying is mental illness isn't mental illness. In fact, at the end, at the very end, there was... I got quite cross with this book. Because at the end you've got Edgar, and it's right at the very, very, very end, and he says, Isla Wilde, it's not a crime to be different, and you're not crazy, you're magic. Like, the book is setting us up with two alternatives. Either Isla does have a mental illness and she is delusional, and all of this fairy tale, magic, fairies, brother princes, which, by the way, happened before her mum died. Happened all before her mum died. All the princes came to her before her mum died. This was not a reaction to her mother's suicide.
Yes.
Right? But either that's all mental illness and a delusion of some kind, or it's not. And Isla's not mad. And
can't
her mum
be
wasn't.
Both? Can't you both have some? Well, the mental illness side is, which makes this all so hard to talk about.
Yeah, it does.
But mental illness side is the block, and the magic is. Because otherwise, we're arguing that the magical side is blocking her as well. It's the magical is actually the block.
Yeah. See, the magic can't, which is why I'm saying I don't think the book is setting this up. I don't think the book, like as a whole, is setting up all of the magical side as a metaphor.
Why did she see the girl in the cage?
Because, as I said, it all happens before her mum
dies. Why did she see the girl in the cage at the age of 16? Why not see it at the age of 10?
Because she had the seance and that's what she calls it. But that's,
yeah, she calls it, yeah. Okay. Well, which, yeah, all right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, look. Look, the problem is that, again, it's the sort of book you'd forgive these things because it's an interesting double play of mental – even though I don't like the idea of mental illness being used as a sort of is it or isn't it? I mean, it's a serious issue. But anyway, okay, you can forgive it of these sins, but it's just so long. And the fact that you have to wait for all the brothers to each disappear in order, and that's what actually makes the book long.
Yeah.
Because you've got Alejandro, got the
– Cristobal.
Cristobal, the father, the grandfather with the mandolin.
Yeah,
and they've all got to be brutally – murdered or whatever,
or disappeared in some way.
Each and another, it doesn't have three at once, it's one, then two, then three. And so Elise Neer has to find things to fill in between, and really it's just, and actually, no, what she does is she shows a woman, a girl who's falling into madness.
Yeah, but must have been from the beginning if you're saying that's what magic is.
Well, that's what I don't get.
But the book isn't saying that's what magic is. In fact, the book is saying the opposite. But isn't
the book saying the magic is protective, except when it isn't?
Yeah. But the problem is that when you start playing around with this sort of stuff, I think, like, as you said before, it requires care. There's a delicacy of touch that's needed here. And I lost a lot of confidence in the book because I found a lot of the language and the imagery and the symbolism used in very careless ways, I do actually.
Yes, I do. I created these earlier.
Some I prepared earlier. No, I do. Okay. So, for example, Isola is obviously obsessed with fairy tales.
Yep.
And the fairy tales that her mum wrote that she remembers as this French woman who is her mum, but she's forgotten that that's her mum. She's bifurcated her mother. So she's obsessed with fairy tales. So her world is and should be fairy tales. Now, when Edgar first sees her, and this is on page 10, like this is when Edgar first sees her, he doesn't know her, he hasn't even heard of her, knows nothing about Isola Wilde. What we get is she's described as in Edgar's eyes, as a glass Cinderella. So this is a chapter which is entitled What Edgar Saw in a Vision as He First Looked at Isola Wilde. Glass heels, glass lips, hand grasping a glass parasol, the draped stiffness of a shatterproof ball gown, a glass Cinderella. Except then we go on and we see Isola, what she actually physically looks like. She's got wavy hair so blonde it burned Edgar's scalp to think about, which is a beautiful line. With rainbow streaks at the roots, like melted Skittles, she's wearing navy blue lipstick. He says on a chain around her neck was what might have been a minuscule golden carriage. No, it's her mother's wedding ring she wears, yes. Which I don't know how you'd think that's a carriage, except Edgar, who we find out later is into movies and Tarantino and anime. Yeah. Why does he see Isola as Cinderella? If anything, she looks like kind of like a deranged bride because she's wearing this big fluffy. No, she's wearing this sort of bridal. Right? But he wouldn't. Why would he think Cinderella? And why would he think glass? Like, this is not Edgar's vision of her. This is the book wanting to set up Isola as a fairy tale girl. But it's not Edgar. Like, why would Edgar see that unless Isola's delusions are immediately infectious? You know what I mean?
Well, that's
– yeah. It lacks the care in that. And then you've got sort of these mentions that are coming from – the book, and it's a line that the author's put in there because it's a good line. It's a line you want to use, but it doesn't work in the book. You've got Ruslana, she's described as she's one of the brother princes, one of Ursula's protectors, and she's described as not a spectre because she had never been human, but a spirit of women's vengeance. And she's sort of the harpy character, the virago, who goes and destroys.
Isn't she the one
the
who
men.
Has the caves of the cave with all the men?
No, that's Cristobal. That's the mermaid, right? So Rosala.
Oh, but she came to protect Cristobal.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, so she's a spirit of women's vengeance, and she goes and destroys men who wrong women. That's what she does when she's not hanging around with Isola. which I don't know how the spirit of women's vengeance is a part-time job. But anyway, so that's at the very beginning. That's how we meet her. That's how she's described. She's one of my favourite characters. I really love Ruslana. Then on page 225, like it's quite a way through the book, Dysela's talking about Edgar, and Ruslana makes this joke. She says, that boy's Jack the Ripper, baby. It means he'll take your heart. I don't see Ruslana, not as she's written and described and how she talks in this book, making that joke. It's out of place. It's a neat joke, but it's out of place. And it's not a joke Ruslana would make. She's not going to joke about a man who violently butchers women. That's not a joke for her. It doesn't have any place in her dialogue. And then there's, I don't know, there's imagery in there that just doesn't work. James, who's a real person but is one of the brother princes Isola has constructed for herself, but he's actually a real person who is a childhood friend. He's a few years older than her.
The rest are real, Kirsten.
Yeah. Okay. He's described in the point where he's turning against her as having a Yakuza sneer. What place does that imagery have in the book? You've got cars that are in a traffic queue that are described as being in a conga line. They're not in a conga line. They're in a traffic queue. There's this bit where there's such careless use of language in the book. I mean, there's some beautiful use of language. One of my favourite lines in the book actually was at the peak of Isola's depression and madness. There's a line that says, Isola was living skinless. Everything got to her. And it's beautiful. And there is some beautiful, beautiful, beautiful writing in this book. But it's almost matched by this sort of carelessness.
Oh,
and sometimes absolute clunkiness. But, yeah, it's matched by, like, the beauty of the language is matched by some very careless.
But do you agree it's too long?
I think it is too long. It did seem to be it's odd because fairy tales in fairy tales you'll have this rhythmic language. Yes. So you'll have these steps that go along. There's this expectation that these steps will be fulfilled. There's repetitions, yep. There's echoes, there's mirroring, there's all this stuff. And this is what this book is doing with that, but it's doing it at novel length.
Yeah. I mean, if it wasn't for the gargoyle character, I would have stopped.
The gargoyle's awesome. He comes at just the right time.
But the problem is that it then makes Isola into a psychotic because she has to feed the gargoyle rare meat. And yeah. She just goes and she decides because
fairies and she's killing fairies and other magical creatures.
Well, at first she doesn't want to.
Yeah, but then she does to save herself.
To save herself. But it's just so grim.
But that's the story.
But it feels like there's no repercussion to that.
No, there isn't. Then that's the problem. There is no repercussion to that.
So she's gone and wiped out really 90% of the fairies in her garden and the other garden.
And at the end, there's because again, love saves and everything is forgiveness and love. And I think
I would have thought that she's painted her fans so much in blood if those fairies are for real.
There's no coming back from that. I wouldn't have thought. But again, everything is love and forgiveness, and love and forgiveness will save.
And it shat me that you know her brother Alejandro leaves this gargoyle with her, probably knowing that he would have to be fed rare meat, and not telling her. And it's another of those things where you think this doesn't make sense.
You're right that the fact that there are no later repercussions for Isola for
wiping out
what
the
she has wrought, in the magic world,
Which made me think that the magic world wasn't real.
Yeah.
Because it didn't matter. Because this is all just in her head, so you can just wipe out an entire community.
You'd want that to be the case, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd have
to. Because I could understand why Isola's doing that. I didn't particularly like her at that point, and I wish she could be stronger, but I could understand why she was doing that. Like, it made perfect sense. But what didn't make sense was, as you say, at the end of that, there's no repercussions.
No, it feels like there's long.
And her brother princes have come back and everything's cool.
Correct.
And there's none of this, you
were a
mess
murderer for a few pages there, but don't worry because you've...
They're only fairies.
Because you remembered that your mum was dead and you sorted out the thing in the forest, so we're all good.
And she didn't do... She wasn't like Emily in Lexicon where Emily was compelled by Yates to use that bear word and to cause the death of all those people.
It's her choice, ultimately.
This is Isola's choice.
Yes.
So, but yeah, I don't, as I said, I don't, we're kind of picking, and there's a lot I love about this book. There is a lot I really do like about it.
Knock 100 pages off. Don't have to, you didn't need to have, as you, I think you said it, in the card, you didn't need to have seven brothers. It's interesting that she calls them all, even the females, brothers. It's that I don't know.
Well, I like that. I mean, the book says that because, you know, it's in fairy tales, it's princes who do the heavy lifting.
Yeah, it was an interesting.
And it's princesses who are a bit useless. Yeah. Interesting that when she goes off to school, her brother princes are described as watching their little sister princess go into the school. So she is then cast by the book from the view of her protective characters as
the princess,
the sister princess.
Yeah.
But
what about the Sylvia Plath thing?
Oh my Kirsten? God.
Do you want to talk about it?
Oh my God.
Because Sylvia Plath is a very important person in your life.
You've
spoken about one of the things that you once spoke to me about, how much you love Sylvia Plath.
Yeah.
From very early on.
Yeah. No, I do. She's been a very strong influence in my life. And so I guess
you
in get my
very
work.
Twitchy when someone else.
I get a bit twitchy. The thing I did not like about this book.
Apart from the last 25
no,
minutes.
No, because that's all. Look, and as I said, it doesn't sound very fair when you talk about this stuff and you pull apart what you don't like and you don't talk about the stuff you do like. And there's much to like in this book.
I think the first third's amazing.
All right.
I just wish it had sustained itself for the rest of the novel.
But what I did not like and what it's never undermined, and I was expecting it to be, is this book through and through from beginning to end, unfortunately, doesn't play with it. It is using it. It is a driving motor in this book, is the romanticization and glamorization of death equals madness equals femininity. And that is throughout the book. We have it's in the language of the book. At the very beginning, Isola's looking in the mirror, and there's a magic mirror, Snow White reference. And she sees her mother, or who we think at that time is her mother, come in, and says, "The mirror should have named her mother best and fairest. Even this ill, even practically bedridden, with her hair a nest to nurse long-flown dreams, crop circles under her eyes, she still held vestiges of beauty, a sort of glamour gone to seed, like an aging Munro might have looked if they'd pumped her guts in time." Later in the book, Isola's dad sees... he's remembering his daughter, Isola, aged 11, came down the stairs, pale but lovely, sadder than she should have known at her age. He had tried to fatten her up, but the weight went to the birds. She was her, but not quite her. She now possessed the strangest calm stolen from girls in that damn storybook. At the very end, Isola turns up on Edgar's doorstep, and she's jumped into a swimming pool, and she's wearing this dyed black ball gown. It's the ball gown from the party that she's dyed black. And she, at this point, she has bruises on her. She is really thin, really pale. She's almost dead in the world of the book. And she's turned up soaking wet on his porch. And he says, "Isola Wilde stood on his porch, beautiful as always, a tad wilder than usual." You know, you've got these descriptions of these women who are described in the book as mad, as thin and frail and vulnerable, and they're described in this very romantic, beautiful way. It goes back to
Edward. Is that an accident?
No, it's not an accident. No, I think it, look, it's a really toxic cultural trope. I mean, it goes back to Edmund Burke and the ideas of the sublime and the beautiful and passive women and it goes back to Poe. I mean, it can't be an accident. She references Poe so much in the book, and you know, Poe's treatise about the composition of stories and how the most poetical thing to write about is the death of a beautiful woman, because you're juxtaposing the tragic death with the beauty, and this is where the Raven came from, and the romanticization of madness and femininity and femininity and death. And this is what happens with Sylvia Plath, and the 2 pages with talk about Sylvia, it made me so angry I had to close the book, put it down. Come back to it, because I'll just read you the where is it? I did make a note of it. Isola, they go to London at one point when Isola was 9. So her mum, her dad, and Isola go to London to see a new doctor for her mum, and they'd gone past the house where Sylvia Plath died, and Isola talks to Sylvia Plath for a little while, and we get it sort of paraphrased in this thing. But it says, the book says, "Isola had been certain for some time that Sylvia Plath was a girl like her. that her eyes saw through to the next dimension like her own, like Mama Sinclair's had or like Lalie Perdue. And she talks to Sylvia Plath. They'd sat for a while on a bench outside the clinic while Father had read the newspaper and picked scabs around his worry-bitten fingers. Isola and Sylvia had whispered about where it came from, this thing they shared. Sylvia Plath had said she could never quite pinpoint its origin, but it had fed her writing, her free-willing thoughts, her appetite for self-destruction, and blah, blah, blah. And Plath is referenced a couple of times throughout the book, and obviously there's a thing with her mother.
And what
makes
you angry about
that?
It just
made me really mad.
Well, why? Because,
so Sylvia Plath's madness is also just seeing the fairy world? Sylvia Plath is like, Sylvia Plath is not like Isola. Sylvia Plath was 32 when she died. She was a mother. She was we didn't know that at the time, but she was a very accomplished poet. Ariel only got published after her death, but I mean, she was publishing poetry.
Yeah,
she was writing criticism.
She had a family.
She was not a young girl who sees fairies.
And you know, from
and
that
her poetry isn't full of fairy tale language. It isn't full of, if you're going to choose a poet to reference, and Sexton's a better choice if you want a, you know, a poet who suffered mental illness and killed herself and wrote about fairy tales. You've got Anne Sexton, but she's American, so.
But from that scene, you would assume that Sylvia Plath knocked herself off at the age of 15 or something, and you know, and
well, her children are referenced, so you know she was a mother. But to put, again, it's this romanticization, yes, of mental illness, and that's not. It made me quite sad throughout the book. At times, it made me angry, and yeah, the Sylvia Plath thing is like, grrr. And I did it when I was 15. Of course you romanticize people like Sylvia Plath and Marilyn Monroe and Anne
Sexton, but you're saying that
and they become their mental illness and they become
their
suicide.
What's the toxic nature? What's the toxic in terms of the feminine, in terms of the feminist argument or the femininity, yeah, side of it? What's the toxic?
Because
thing?
The idea that this is glamorous, that this is beautiful, that a woman who is vulnerable or dying or dead or super thin or, you know, insane, that there is a yeah, beauty, okay, there, and that is something to be desired and makes you desirable. Yep. That is everywhere in our culture. It really is. And it's, you know, it's madness makes men geniuses and it makes women sexy. That's kind of how our culture views that gender dichotomy.
And you're saying there's nothing sexy about what Sylvia Plath did at the age of 32. It's not something to be glamorized.
It's not something to be glamorized. And it also reduces her. It reduces her to that, yeah, and she was much more than that. She kept bees. She went walking in the country. She painted her house. She had children and family and friends who, yeah, loved her. She had.
This,
she was not reduced to a gas
pages,
oven at the end of her life.
No, and this book for 400 pages reduces Isola's mum to what she did in the bathtub. Because it's that act, mm, that results in everything else.
Yeah.
And it comes back to that act. It all goes circles around that act. Yes, she did her fairy tales, mm, but that in a sense seems to just be a fuel for that act as well.
And it doesn't lift at the end when Isola has dispatched the dead girl who is her other self, yep, and the wicked witch who is Lilio, who is her mother, and all of that's done. And I wouldn't want it to be like happily ever after. Oh, it's all nice now.
Yeah.
But you still have the same use of language in the last part of the book. You still have Edgar who is still romanticizing her. Yeah. And I don't know exactly what she's done, because there's this bit at the end where, you know, at the very end where they're talking and it says, that night Isola told Edgar everything. She told him what had happened to her mother and to her, all without breaking the unspoken code of the Nimues, which is the name for the magic. In this book, there were some things about girls that boyfriends weren't meant to understand. So what did she tell him? Like, if she didn't, like, if she told him everything, but she didn't, then she,
yeah,
told him nothing,
well,
right?
Well, Edgar, my mum killed herself at 10, when I was 10.
And I've been sad.
And I've basically blocked that for the
whole
time.
Like, so
she
hasn't told
life.
Him everything.
No.
The thing says she told him everything, the things that other people would have thought she was mad about, the thing that James told her
so
she was crazy about.
So why'd you jump
but
in the swimming pool?
But then it says
pool?
She doesn't tell him
because
everything.
Because why'd you jump in the swimming pool? That bit where she thinks that Grape's about to be,
yeah,
attacked. Oh,
so
I don't know
yeah,
you're right, you're
what
right.
She has told James, right?
Yeah, you're
so
right.
So does he still think she – I don't know. I think, yeah, it's a very – like,
I mean, she
would
have told him that she was broken as a result of her mother's death.
Yes.
But that's
– but she hasn't told him everything then.
No.
She doesn't actually trust him enough to tell him about the world she sees. She doesn't because there's some things,
yeah,
that boyfriend shouldn't know. and he still sees her in this you know, idealized crazy girl way.
A fragile, right? Porcelain little girl who needs to be.
He sees real evidence of whether there's magic or not. As you say, it's not one and the same thing. So whether the magic is real or the magic is an extension of Isla's mental illness, within her magical world, she's breaking down.
Yeah, yeah, she's going mad either way.
And James sees real evidence of her her distress and thinks she's beautiful.
Yeah, no, you're right. And that's the thing that
and that's what the book does.
It isn't just magic madness, and you choose one. As you said, even if the magic stuff's all real,
she is still
she's falling
in
apart.
Incredible distress.
Yeah,
over and above what's happening in Magic Land.
Correct.
And I still haven't made up my mind whether the very last line, I find it incredibly ominous, but I haven't made up my mind whether it's intended to be ominous. I suspect it's intended to be sweet
what's
and romantic.
The last line?
The very last line is just a quip. It is, and they lived ever after, whether they were happy about it or not. But the actual last line of dialogue, the last little bit, is Edgar and Isla on bed, sort of curled up, nice and happy. She leaned into him, shaped herself. "I love you, Edgar Llewellyn," Isla murmured into his hair. "Love you too, Annabel Lee." Which is, to me, ominous. Because Annabel,
the reference to Poe again.
That's the reference to Annabel Lee, who in Poe's poem is dead. Dead girl. Ghost girl. Or, beautiful dead girl. Beautiful, beautiful
dead
girl.
But that was a running gag, though.
It's a running gag, but I find it ominous because he's still calling her Annabel Lee, you know? When that whole dance with death and madness that Isla's been having throughout the entire book, she's won that and she's now recovering. And yes, she still gets sad. The book makes that very clear. It's not like, hey, everything's great now. But I just find it ominous. I find that Edgar is still putting her into this box of the beautiful dead mad girl.
Just to get a bit go a bit beyond the mental illness magic side, I still don't see how this is a horror novel. So I don't want to get into genre stuff here, and I've just done it. But it's won a horror award.
There's horrific stuff in there.
Not an issue?
It's very dark fantasy. It's horror, as we've said in the past. It's a very slippery genre. Right. I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it's what you would. I think this belongs more in the horror genre than Lexicon belongs in the fantasy genre. How about I put it that way?
Okay. All right. No,
it's not square in the centre of the genre. It's not a book you'd automatically jump to.
But I'm surprised it wasn't in the fantasy ballot. That's all.
It wasn't in the fantasy ballot over Lexicon, for example. But again, I don't know whether it was offered to the judges to consider for the fantasy ballot. I do want to say some good things about the book. I do want to say that, there's a lot of work put into even though, as I said, there's not a perfect unity of language and symbolism, but there is a lot pulled into the fairy tale stuff. There is a lot of references to not just fairy tales, but to things like Alice in Wonderland, obviously. I mean, the cover is an Alice in Wonderland cover.
And the illustrations are gorgeous,
Dorothy,
by the way.
Dorothy, the Wizard of Oz, bringing in mythology. There's all this stuff brought
into the drawings
book.
Inside, they're really pretty. They're very nice.
They are nice. This should have been a book I adored, and maybe the expectation was a bit too high.
Look, I haven't been as textual as you. But for me, at the end of the day, as a novel, it doesn't sustain itself as a novel. It's a novella, if anything, as what it should have been. I would read something else by Elise Neer because that first third is wonderful.
Oh, yeah, I definitely would. I think...
I don't know. This was the problem. I came into this podcast having read that one recently, and yet I felt I had more to say about Lexicon than I did about...
Yeah.
That's why you've essentially taken over the conversation because... To me, it just left a nothing with me. It I read it and it just slid off. And
whereas I read it and the parts of it that I didn't like, I really didn't like, and that kind of coloured the whole book. Look, it's like with Love Is the Law that we talked about on the last episode, that you can give a book or a movie or whatever narrative you're reading, you give it a lot of lead. It's not as though it starts off with something and you go, oh, I don't like that. You give it a lot of lead because you're hoping it's introducing an element that's maybe problematic or difficult or delicate, whatever it is, but that it's introducing it with an intent to examine it, to turn it over, yeah. to play with it, to hopefully, you know, undermine prejudices and things at the end. And so you do give it a lot of leeway. But then when you get to that end and it hasn't done that,
yeah.
And as with Love is the Law, it's just saying, yes, all women are stupid except for the exceptional girl. And with this book, when it's saying, yes, you know, mad, dead, frail women are beautiful and desirable.
Yeah, I agree.
You go, and romance. It's the romanticization. And yet, I think
it has a great character, Grape. Her characterization is
spot
on.
I wish there was more. Actually, that's the other thing. I wish there was more. Grape disappears at the end. It's just Isola and Edgar, the new boy, who I think is a bit creepy, to be honest. And Grape disappears because Grape gets a girlfriend, so I guess she's happy too somewhere. Because Grape and Isola's relationship breaks. Well, their relationship breaks down, and completely. Grape, to her credit, is obviously understanding of Isola's mental condition, if not the reasons for it.
We never get closure.
It never comes back.
And Grape actually is the best character in the whole book.
It's Isola and Edgar at the end, yeah. Right? Like, it's this doomed couple who are going to live ever after, whether they're happy about it or not. I'm possibly reading that in a more sinister voice than the book would intend. And Grape's off somewhere. I guess she's happy because she's got a girlfriend. But the friendship between Grape and Isola is abandoned.
Grape gets mistreated. Mm. There's no closure on it. But in fact shows that she's probably the most empowered person in the book.
But the friendship is abandoned, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely abandoned. I know.
It's abandoned for love. But isn't friendship love? Isn't what Grape and Isola have that they've had for I can't remember exactly when they met, but it was
well, you know what?
When they were little girls, it was before Isola mothers died. Yeah. So their friendship, which is the one enduring real relationship in the entire book, which fractures and is threatened by what happens, whether it's magic or just mental illness. Well, I'm not diminishing mental illness, but whether it's Isola's mental breakdown or the magic or both.
But it's just forgotten.
That relationship is threatened and fractured and unresolved and abandoned. It's abandoned by the book. We don't get
but
that.
But not
at
in
the
a
end.
Tragic way. Not in a, oh my God, it's abandoned. Just in a, well.
It's just forgotten. It's because the important thing is Edgar and Isola in the book's view. And in my view, I want that friendship between them. I want to know that they're still friends. I want to, or if not, why? I mean, that's the relationship that's important to me as a reader.
Agreed.
It's Isola and Grape, not Isola and Edgar, who's a bit creepy.
If the book had been just been a Grape, I would have loved that book.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that Isola does all the finale is all her on her own. I mean, her brothers
which is
appear
really
at the
good.
End.
She works it out. She works out the right
she empowers herself in that.
It.
But it would have been lovely if her friends who have stuck with her, Edgar Skeevy aside, James is the only brother that doesn't turn up because he's real.
Real. And it has turned out to be one of those nice guys.
Yeah,
quote,
well, but he's not. But it would have been nice to see them be involved in some way, and yet they're not. I'm really sad
that the relationship with Grape and Isola is abandoned.
And that's
the book.
Where the structure
I'm really
of the book just
sad
doesn't work.
About
the structure,
that. Because Grape is wonderful, and Grape sticks by her, and Grape is scared.
I agree, but
she sticks by Isola.
You need
she
to
tries
be slavish
to, help her.
To a fairy tale. The structure of the book falls apart, and things like Grape just get forgotten.
And when we say a fairy tale, it's not like this book is retelling a classic. The fairy tale this book is structured around is made up. It's one of Lilio Perdue's fairy tales. It's made up. So that fairy tale could have been anything.
Could have been four
that the
princes.
Author had created to serve the purpose as a structural element in the book. Yeah. So it's not hampered by an existing story in culture that you are trying to work with.
Yep, so, I agree.
Yeah, no, actually, I'm glad you mentioned Grape because that's something I did want to talk about because I just felt, that abandonment really strongly, really strongly. I don't care that Isla's curled up with Edgar, who she met a couple months ago and thinks she's pretty because she's sick. It's Grape who's important in
Isla's
life. And I don't think that just because Grape has a girlfriend now and he's happy in that part of her life – That means she doesn't care about Isola.
There's a feel
because
also
their
that
friendship
Edgar,
isn't
Edgar's,
a replacement for romantic
love. The reason why
love.
Edgar wins is because Edgar's the one who actually goes out to do the questioning and the research.
Yeah.
Although none of it actually comes to anything.
No, it doesn't.
Whereas Grape just, I suppose, does
Grape is there. Grape is there emotionally. Grape is there constantly despite everything Isola's doing. And as you say, getting treated shabbily in a lot of the time towards the end. Understandably, I'm not saying that's bad, but Grape's there.
Yeah.
And it's though the book is saying Isola has Edgar, Grape has her new girlfriend, and those relationships are primary over over a friendship. Romantic love trumps them. They don't need their friendship anymore because they've got lovers now. But, and that's, quite frankly, again, it's bullshit. It's bullshit.
The book doesn't even make that commentary. It doesn't make any commentary.
It makes the commentary by abandoning that relationship, by abandoning that friendship. And not bringing those two girls back together, and saying that they're friends.
Elise's intent.
I'm not saying it's intentional. Okay. I'm saying this is what the book is doing. The book is putting these two girls who had this very strong friendship, which was tested so thoroughly, and it's going, oh, but they're with lovers now, so their friendship was just a practice run. Yeah, and we do that. It's a cultural thing.
And I know how mean that sounds.
The idea that friendship is a lesser relationship you're than right. romantic love.
I know how mean, and the way you say it sounds savage, but it's true. That's exactly how the book reads.
Mm.
Anyway, look, we've read two Orealis award-winning novels, which, yes, we've struggled with a little bit. But anyway, and what's funny is that next month we're not recommending the books each other as well.
Again, I'm a bit scared. Because what's happening next month, Ian?
Well, next month we're doing a live episode in front of a live audience.
Yes. Again, assuming continuum.
A continuum 10, assuming people turn up. And most years they have turned up. Not in droves. There's been people there. You can sort of hear them in the background. That'll be over the long weekend of the 6th to 9th of June. So you will get another episode very quickly
behind this one. Well, it's... No, you won't. Be right. About this because I'm straight after continuum. I'm away for a little bit, so
you won't get a quick episode then.
Probably another week.
And as traditional, the guests on the podcast will be the guests of honours, Jim Hines and Amblin Quaymulliner.
Yes,
and they of course have recommended the books.
Yes, they have,
which is what I was hinting at before. And those two books are The Curse of Chalion by Lois McMaster Bujold, World Fantasy Award winner, and Hugo too, I think, in 2001. And The Lives of Tao by Wesley Chu, which was a book published by Angry Robot not so long ago. In fact, it's a sequel.
I've been meaning to read for ages, so it's a sequel.
There is a sequel to it.
Oh, okay, good.
obviously, you weren't looking forward to reading The Curse of Chalion.
Oh, no, it's not that I'm not looking forward to it.
Well, it's been out for 13 years.
I haven't actually read any Lois.
You haven't bothered to read it. No, to be fair, I haven't either.
I haven't bothered. It's been one of those many, many, many millions of books in the world that I have not gotten to.
Yeah, so rude.
So it's nice. This is one of the good things about doing this podcast is that you read books you wouldn't otherwise pick up for various reasons.
I've had Curse of Chalion on my shelf for 13 years. Yes. And, yes, I couldn't find it. Anyway, because it's packed between a million books. So.
Have you found it now?
I have read it.
Oh, dear. Okay.
So, yes, I did find it through all the muck in the end. It's 500 pages long.
Okay. So that will be next month. That will be exciting. I like having guests on.
Now, after that podcast, though, we're going bi-monthly. I'm just saying.
Oh, well.
There's no prelude. There's no lead up. We're going to
say that so quick. You need to say it again.
We are going to do a podcast once every 2 months.
Yes.
That is what bi-monthly means. And the reason we're doing that is it's social life in general.
It's mainly that I have hit the wall time-wise.
You've hit the wall time-wise. You're doing a doctorate. I'm not at fault. I would do monthly.
It's completely my fault. It's completely my fault, listeners. You can blame me. Send the hate mail in my direction. I have been overcome by the amount of reading that is required. I'm struggling. Otherwise, we can do it monthly and Ian will just recommend all the books because I don't have time to read books for recommendations.
Look, we don't know if this will be permanent or not, but it will definitely be the case until Kirsten's done it, which is how long for the doctorate?
About 10 years.
Yeah.
No, it's not that long.
Yeah, but close. So
It'll be a little while.
It means six episodes a year.
Six episodes a year. Episodes a year.
Which means we're still eligible for a Hugo.
For God's sake.
It's true.
Why? What's your regularity required
four.
So we could go quarterly.
No, we're not doing that.
Kidding.
No, because I enjoy doing this. Look, I'll miss it as much as you guys will.
Occasionally we might pop like a special episode in there.
That'll be entirely based on you, Kirsten, if you have this sudden desire to do a special episode. We still love you all.
We do.
We do love the feedback. We do love all you guys getting on the tweets.
Yeah, it's not just we got a Hugo nomination and now we're resting on our laurels. Oh, we'll go by monthly now. We don't need to do it every month anymore. We've done the work.
Oh, I thought that was actually the real one. Yeah. No, but look, it hopefully won't be permanent, but it will be for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
So I have not much more to say other than to say please send feedback. I don't know why we do this anymore, because mostly the Twitter is where the feedback
is. The Twitter is where the feedback is.
Because you haven't received anything in email, have you?
Not for a while, no.
No. So, but anyway, look, just for the sake of tradition, comment to us on the website at writerandcritic.podbean.com. Email us at writerandcritic@gmail.com. There's the Twitter, which is Writer and Critic, and you do follow us because we get the messages, sometimes even to our own personal accounts.
Yes.
And there's some really good conversations. Michelle Goldsmith's another one who sends a lot. Charles, yes, of course.
Hi, Michelle.
Fred. You know, the usual. Paul Wimey. It's good. The same four people every month. No, we don't have a problem with that. It's better having no friends.
Oh, that sounds so sad.
No, look, it's beautiful.
That sounds really insulting.
It is insulting.
Oh, my goodness.
No, I mean, I want a podcast to drop and hundreds to be responding, but I'll take what we get.
You don't want that Hugo Award, do you?
No, I've lost it already. And, of course, you know, iTunes, if you can be bothered, 5 stars would be nice. Mm. So that is it from us for this month. And as I said, please, if you're in Melbourne, come to Continuum and see us.
Yes.
It'll be for 2 hours. So bring some popcorn.
Popcorn?
Well, just something.
Bring a pony.
Oh, fuck. If you bring a pony, that will be, like, amazing. I will laugh.
If someone brings me a real live pony, we'll do this every week, I promise.
The podcast.
Yeah.
So the bet is this: if someone brings a pony,
a real live pony that I can keep and take home,
and take to Ballarat.
Yes.
This podcast will be weekly.
Yes.
Okay. So where am I? What am I getting? And where am I in this?
I don't care. I have a pony.
Bye.
Bye. Someone brings a fucking horse, I will die.